This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
For a 7-minute video on obscure economic policy to go viral was very surprising.
So why do they call it the quantitative easing? Why don't they just call it the printing money?
Because the printing money is the last refuge of failed economic empires and banana republics, and the Fed doesn't want to admit this is their only idea.
As a trader on Wall Street back in November 2010, Omid Malakhan found himself being asked by a lot of friends if he could explain for them what quantitative easing was. The irreverent video he made to help them has been viewed millions of times, possibly because it's not a concept many others were trying to describe, but mostly because it was very funny.
So what is deflating right now?
The only thing deflating that I can see is the Fed's credibility.
I was shocked by how popular it became, because normally in video circles, what they tell you is if a video is going to go viral, then it should be very short and about cats.
The Ben Bernanke has no business experience.
Does the Ben Bernanke have a lot of policy experience?
No, the Ben Bernanke has no policy experience.
So what qualifies him to run the Fed?
I don't know, maybe the fact that he has a nice beard.
But it wasn't just the American Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, that adopted the policy of QE. So far, the Bank of England has spent £375 billion buying up government bonds, and it's just announced a further £70 billion in bond purchases as part of its response to the vote for Brexit. One arm of the state is buying up the debt of another.
Is this an episode of The Twilight Zone?
I don't think so.
Are you sure?
So what is QE? Has it worked? And why are we doing it again? Join me in the briefing room, and we'll try to find out. Shortly, I'll be joined by a panel of experts to discuss this, but first I'm joined by BBC reporter Neil Rozelle, who's going to help to explain some of the theory behind QE.
OK, David, for the purpose of the next few minutes, I want you to imagine that I'm Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England. I'm Canadian too, by the way, so that might help. You are the new Chancellor, Philip Hammond. I've come to see you at number 11 Downing Street because the vote to leave the European Union has clearly been a shock to the economy. It's created uncertainty in the markets, and there's a risk this shock could mean that banks slow down their lending and that businesses don't invest quite so much. So the Bank of England needs to do something to make sure that credit continues to flow, and I need you, Mr. Hammond, to authorize it. Okay. So what we want to do is we want more quantitative easing.
Quantitative easing is one of those phrases that sounds both technical and slightly disgusting. What is it?
Okay, well, let's just go back to basics, and I don't want to patronize you, but how do you understand banking to work?
Okay, so I have some money. I put it in a bank account, and the bank pays me a little bit of interest. And with the same money and those of other people, it then lends it out to businesses and others, and it charges them a greater rate of interest, and that's how banks make their money.
That's how you think it works, right? Well,
that's how I was taught it works.
Well, indeed, but the truth is that's not how it works. And the Bank of England actually published an interesting paper on this a few years ago called Money Creation in the Modern Economy, and it sounds dull, but it's quite an important little piece, and it dispels this myth. And I know it sounds technical, but understanding how banks really work will help you understand how QE works. I promise.
Don't stop, Governor. Don't stop.
Okay, well, let's take your example again. Imagine the borrower coming to the bank for a loan to buy, say, a house. And the bank says, okay. The bank does not take the money from another saver and give it to the borrower to buy the house. Instead, it creates new money, which is then used to buy the house.
Hold on. It creates new money. I thought it was the Bank of England that created our money.
No. In most cases, it's commercial banks.
So the transaction created the money for itself?
In a manner of speaking, yes.
So that's kind of like magic, really.
It is the magic of modern banking. The flip side of this is that when the mortgage is repaid, that money is destroyed. So the money is created and destroyed.
What do you mean destroyed?
Well, they just kind of draw a line through it on a balance sheet. Now, in the normal running of things, if banks think the economy is moving along nicely and they think borrowers are going to be able to repay, they're quite happy to continue creating this new money, and the economy grows. Within certain parameters, obviously. The banks can't just create as much new money as they like.
All right, so if you don't create money, the banks do, what does the Bank of England do?
We kind of police how much new money is created. So we've said we want inflation to grow at a slow and stable rate of 2%. So we do want new money to be created, just not too much.
Because if there is too much, then inflation goes up.
Exactly. So there's a downside. Now, we can influence how much new money the banks create by changing the base rate. So if we want to encourage more money to be created, we can lower the base rate. If we want to slow it down, we can raise it. It's like putting a foot on an accelerator.
Perhaps I'm the wrong man to be Chancellor, but can you explain to me what the base rate actually is?
So the base rate is the rate that commercial banks can borrow money from us, from the Bank of England.
Now, actually, for some time now, interest rates have been really, really, really low.
Historically low, actually. The base rate is now down to 0.25%. And the problem is, banks still aren't lending enough. And this is why I'm here. So changing the base rate is no longer an effective tool for us. And this is what happened after the financial crisis. This is where quantitative easing comes in.
Why is it called quantitative easing?
What the Bank of England is trying to do is directly increase the quantity of money in supply rather than just trying to influence it through interest rates. And we're going to do it by buying up government bonds in exchange for new money.
Okay, you know I'm a new chancellor, so humour me again here. What exactly are government bonds? What do they do?
Chancellor, this is how you borrow money. They're effectively IOUs, and big investors like pension funds will say, fine, we'll take that IOU from you, we'll give you a lump of cash, and in 5, 10, maybe 20 years, you'll pay us back.
So when I, as chancellor, want to borrow money, I issue government bonds. I sell them off to other people.
Correct.
Well, in that case, you're in luck, Governor, because in my Treasury briefing notes, I've discovered that the UK government is more than £1.6 trillion in debt, and we're borrowing more all the time, so there will be plenty of government bonds for you to buy from me.
You are deeply in debt and heading deeper into debt, but I'm afraid I'm not your man directly. We are not allowed to buy bonds directly from the Treasury. The European Union says we can't.
Well, if we don't buy these bonds from you, who do we buy them from?
Well, remember I said pension funds, for example, might be taking your IOUs. So you can buy them from pension funds. They like to hold your bonds because they're a low-risk form of investment and they can guarantee that they will meet their future obligations to pensioners.
Okay, but I can't quite see how buying our bonds back from pension funds helps the economy. I mean, after all, pension funds don't lend out money to households and businesses and stimulate stuff, do they?
Here's how we hope it works. When pension funds sell their bonds to us, the Bank of England, they suddenly have more money in their accounts. The money is created, just like with the mortgage. Pension funds, traditionally, with this money, they often will turn around and buy more government bonds. But because we, the Bank of England, have entered the market and we are buying more and more of these bonds, it's like any other commodity, the price is going up. So we're hoping, the theory is that pension funds will take this new money that's been created and perhaps invest it in something else, say the bond of a large company. The hope is the large company will then take this money and grow their business and so grow the economy. That's the theory. That's why we need quantitative easing.
Okay, let me just put all this together. Okay. Mm-hmm. You will buy bonds that we, the government, have issued, but not from us. You will buy them from pension funds and others with the idea that they will then spend that money on other things which aren't government bonds, like shares in companies and so on, which will create growth in the economy because the value of those shares, etc., rises and everybody feels a bit better. Is that essentially it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Instead of buying government bonds, they're going to buy corporate bonds, they're going to buy shares, they're going to put the money into the real economy.
And you want me to authorize you to buy how much?
I'm asking you to authorize us to buy an extra $70 billion. In assets.
Now, I haven't been Chancellor very long, but even I know that $70 billion is quite a lot of dough. So if you don't mind, I'm going to call in a couple of other experts before I sign off on this one.
Of course, Chancellor.
To that purpose, joining me now in the briefing room are Stephen Jones, Chief Investment Officer with Kames Capital. He's on the line from Edinburgh. Francis Coppola, finance blogger and former banker, and Toby Nangle, a fund manager with the asset management company Columbia Threadneedle. Toby's an expert on financial markets. Now, Toby, what was happening in the markets to make us turn to quantitative easing?
I guess you have to turn your mind back to the post-Lehman Brothers crash. There were concerns about the shortage of money sitting around in the system. And so by the Bank of England coming in and essentially creating a lot of new money by buying assets out there in the market, that flushed the system full of money and calmed panic about the ability of the banking system to really continue as it was.
Stephen Jones, you manage funds. You were managing them back in 2009. Back then, did quantitative easing seem an unusual measure to you?
It did, yes. I mean, in hindsight, it was the next logical step for central banks to execute, having taken interest rates down to zero, having got cash levels to 0.5% in the UK's case, 0.1% in the case of the US economy, then the only way to stimulate growth and economic activity was to push money into the system, as has been said, and also to take longer term interest rates, those set by government bonds, ever lower.
Okay, so it's 2009 and the Bank of England has launched its first round of purchases amounting to £75 billion. How successful was it?
The success did come interest rates that the government has to pay to borrow money to fund its deficit, the amount of money it spends over and above the amount it raises, and fell quite dramatically. And this also helped companies that have to pay similar or slightly higher interest rates than governments fund any investment activity or fundraising that they needed to do. So it was successful. It is a fairly blunt instrument, but it has achieved very low interest rates for a great deal of time now.
Toby Nangle, specifically, what's the evidence that QE worked?
If you are the UK government and you're borrowing for 30 years, you announce the amount that you want to borrow and you see what is the rate that I have to pay every year for the next 30 years. When this started, that rate was around about 4.5% per year. Now, if they do it, it's around 1.5%, although you could actually associate it with a variety of other things as well. So it's very hard to conclusively link one to the other, but a lot of studies have had a go and they mostly find that there is a linkage.
Francis Coppola, you've been a banker and you understand the mechanics of this better than most. I want to come on to a problem which seems inherent in this process. The Bank of England effectively signals in advance the price that it is prepared to pay for bonds before it's going to buy them.
Yeah, it does. And in so doing, it does influence the market price. I think we saw recently that it signalled the price at which it wanted to buy some bonds and the market kind of went, no, that's not good enough. And so they didn't actually manage to buy all the bonds that they wanted and they had to raise their price. So there's a little bit of an exchange between the market and the bank about pricing. But yes, the bank does indicate the price at which it will buy and that does influence the market price.
Just from a kind of commonsensical point of view, if you signal well in advance how much you're prepared to pay for something, doesn't that kind of give all kinds of people reasons to try and beat you up on the price? Because they kind of know your minimum game and so on. It's not how you do it in a souk in Istanbul.
Maybe I can just jump in here. Asset price inflation is not a bug, but a feature of quantitative easing. The whole point of quantitative easing is to push asset prices up. And so conducting an auction, which is how they actually buy the bonds. They have a kind of reverse auction. Who's going to sell me this? And you find the person who's going to do it at the lowest levels. to drive up the price is actually the whole point of quantitative easing.
Why can't the Bank of England just buy the gilts directly from the Treasury?
I actually think that would have a completely different effect. Are you in the business of doing QE in order to finance a government's deficit, or are you in the business of doing QE in order to encourage investors to do something different? Because if the government is issuing gilts, which are then bought directly by the Bank of England, you haven't influenced investor behaviour at all.
Yeah, just to jump in what Toby on that, there's this phrase of portfolio balance effect. The idea behind buying these gilts from the market was that you'd buy them from pension funds, from insurance companies, who basically have to hold something like them by pushing the price up above the level at which they'd actually want to hold them. And they'd have to find something else that they liked, which was a little bit different, like a corporate bond. So that would then filter through into lower corporate interest rates and as such stimulate the economy. But apart from not being having a different effect, which I agree with Francis there, it would actually have also been illegal under the Maastricht Treaty. And so until the UK leaves the European Union, it would actually be illegal under European law.
Can I jump in on that one? Because it's specifically, it's Article 123 of the Lisbon Treaty.
Article 123 is a good article.
Yeah.
I can remember that.
Yeah, which specifically says that a central bank may not finance a government.
Let's talk about the impact of all this. Toby Nangle, what does the Bank of England's own research tell us about the effect of quantitative easing on households? What's happened to them?
Well, the bank would say that it's helped households across the country by essentially creating easier or looser monetary conditions. So it's as though interest rates have fallen even further, and that has kept more people in employment, have met more businesses going and the like. But when we look at households across the country, it's quite distributional, really. So people who are savers would find that their saving incomes have gone down. People who are borrowers would find that actually they're in a better situation than they would have otherwise been. They might not be bust. So it really depends on individual circumstances.
On where you were in all that. Yeah. Stephen Jones, are there any losers? I suppose what I'm really interested in, given your background, is what has been the impact for pensions and savers?
There, it's a more mixed story. Pensions funds traditionally own a lot of government bonds. So you might think that, you know, with the price going up, with the bank buying constantly, that they would be doing very well. They do own the bonds for a reason, though, and they're to back the future claims and payments that they have to make to their pensioners in 5, 10, 20, 30 years' time. And the reality of the pension system is that they never owned enough bonds to really back the future liabilities, the future payments they were on the hook for. So they weren't natural sellers of bonds. And if they were to fill the gap that they had, then they had to try and buy bonds in competition, if you like, with the Bank of England at ever higher prices.
So why would pension funds sell their bonds to the Bank of England? Why don't they just say, go away?
Well, pension funds, in many cases, have not been sellers of bonds. It's been other holders of them, foreign institutions in particular, and the like. Indeed, pension funds, as the gap between the assets they hold and the liabilities they've got get bigger, have been forced to try and compete with the bank and buy more bonds to close those gaps or to see big deficits emerge in their funding of their pension schemes.
So let me get this right. Instead of portfolio rebalancing, what they've done is found themselves in competition for bonds and finding the price of the bonds that they need going up.
In the context of pension funds, yes.
Toby Nangle, you're anxious to come in here.
I just wanted to offer some things which you might find rather astonishing, and that is, number one, there aren't actually enough bonds in the UK to meet pension fund demands, as in if all pensions were going to be fully funded with bonds, there simply aren't enough bonds to start with, forget QE.
So that means that companies are forced to divert monies towards their pension schemes, partially as a result of the impact of QE?
Potentially, yes.
Potentially, or is it happening?
On average, in the 10 years before QE, they were paying around about 0.9% of GDP into their pension schemes every year. In the past 10 years, it's averaged around about 2.4% of GDP a year goes into pension schemes. So there's a huge change pre and post.
And a large part of that is QE. That is a very big change. And I suppose some of it will be partially offset by the returns in the shares as a result of the economic stimulation coming out of QE. Do we buy that?
Absolutely. I mean, the asset values are higher everywhere, not only in bonds. And so if you looked at overall pension fund assets, they've actually gone from around about $775 billion to $1.3 trillion over the period, but the deficit has grown hugely over the same time because the estimate of the value of liabilities has gone through the roof.
Now, Francis Coppola, can I get to something else which tends to be said about quantitative easing, and I, of course, as the Chancellor, have picked this up, which is the impact upon house prices and people with mortgages and so on. What is it that we can say has happened to the housing market as a consequence of QE, do you think?
I think it's quite complicated, and I'm always very wary.
I was afraid you were going to say
yeah,
that.
Because I actually think it's quite dangerous to try and separate out QE from low interest rates. People on standard variable rates, for example, have done extremely well, but a lot of that is simply out of low rates. So there are people who've done very well out of this who would have expected to pay far more in interest on their mortgages than they have been doing since about 2009. Conversely, I think we have seen that the effect of all of this has been actually to put house prices up.
So how does that work? How does QE work so that actually it puts prices up where you don't want them?
The principal effect of QE is to push up all asset prices. We've been talking specifically about government bonds, but it also raises the price of all other assets because the whole point of QE is to divert people away from government bonds and into other assets. And property is widely regarded as a safe asset.
Since we're talking about house prices and the effect of QE on house prices, we have a new Prime Minister. She's not a fan. Back in July, when we still thought there was going to be a leadership contest following David Cameron's resignation, Theresa May gave a speech in Birmingham setting out her plans to reform the economy. And she took aim at this policy.
Monetary policy in the form of super low interest rates and quantitative easing has helped those on the property ladder at the expense of those who can't afford to own their own home.
Now, that doesn't actually sound as if she was terribly happy with the prospect. We talked earlier about the headline figure of £70 billion. Now, £60 billion of that, as we said, is in government bonds. So how come the Bank of England has just announced it's going to buy another £60 billion worth of government bonds? Francis Coppola.
Don't think it's quite like that, because remember that the Bank of England has operational independence, and also remember that decisions about things like interest rates and QE are not just made by Mark Carney, they're made by the Monetary Policy Committee. Interestingly, not all of them necessarily agree on this, but the actual government bond part of this round of QE was a very split vote. So I think it's more that the Monetary Policy will make a decision and the Chancellor is not going to override that decision.
Tell me now, how will we know if any of this works? I mean, what will we see if it does work? And conversely, what would happen if it doesn't?
It's such an interesting question, because we can lose sight of what the whole point of this is supposed to be. You know, the mechanism is to raise asset prices, but the point of it is to try and deliver 2% inflation in the UK economy. That's something which hasn't been achieved for the past 3 years. So if you were to look at the combination of policies that are being put forward, including quantitative easing, it's that inflation rate is around about 2%. So we don't slip into deflation, which many people understand to be quite destructive to the economic well-being of the country.
I would also say that the mandate that the bank is pursuing is one that it is trying to create some growth, some traction, to allow it ultimately to go back to a normal world where it doesn't have to engage in buying of bonds day in, day out, and where it can take interest rates off zero.
Well, you raise this question of going back to the normal. Now, I seem to recall that we were supposed to somehow kind of gradually get out. There was a word for this, which was taper,
wasn't it? We were
supposed
to taper yeah. out of these extraordinary programmes over time, yes.
What was the idea of the taper? What is the taper?
It's just the very gradual removal of the extraordinary levels of stimulus that have been supplied by central banks around the world. And it relies on the creation of a bit of inflation, higher levels of economic activity, and a resumption of normality, whatever that might be, but it's certainly something better than we're kind of experienced to date. The US has been able, very, very tentatively, to raise interest rates at the back end of last year on the back of their stronger economic profile. But back a couple of years ago when they tried that in 2013, there was something called a taper tantrum, whereby they kind of misjudged how much economic activity there was and the market assessment of that. And so their initial thoughts of tapering, of reducing stimulus, caused something of a swoon in the market, a toddler's tantrum, that was a period of great volatility over the summer that eventually stopped them in their tracks, and they pulled away from doing anything at that point and kept interest rates low for another 18 months or so.
Francis, you answer this. What's the Bank of England going to do with all these bonds?
Well, when they mature, the Bank of England actually reinvests. It buys more to replace the ones that have matured. So the idea is, at the moment, to keep the level of bond purchases the same. It has been $375 billion up till now. They're now adding another $70 billion. But to keep the level of bond purchases the same. At the moment, the Bank of England doesn't appear to have any plans to reduce that. The Federal Reserve has looked at this, and their view is that they will raise interest rates before they start to reduce their stock of bond purchases. So it seems to me that central banks are going to have this stock of bonds for a very long time.
Now, let's suppose, going back to the end of July, beginning of August, when the discussions were happening about whether or not we should go through this next round of quantitative easing, and the Chancellor wanted your advice on whether you should say to Mark Carney, yes, QE to that level is good, go ahead, or, you know what, I'd rather we didn't. Francis, what would you have advised?
I think, myself, there's been altogether too much reliance on central banks, and I think that governments have used central banks to avoid doing anything themselves.
But at the end of that, would you have said yes or no?
I think I would have said probably no. I think they should be looking at fiscal policy now.
Stephen Jones.
I think that the argument for continuing to do this is quite robust. I think there is need globally, and specifically in the UK, to put some higher levels of growth into economies. And therefore, using every tool in the box, taking interest rates down to nearly zero in the UK's case, buying some more bonds, gives you a better chance of doing that. But the other thing I would say is that the Chancellor should take the advantage of very low interest rates, allow himself to access them and do some fiscal policy as well. So I agree with Francis on that. Spending a bit of money on infrastructure is much talked about. It now needs to be done.
It's one all. Toby and Angle, you have the casting vote. Yes or no?
I say QE was a fantastic policy of 2009. I don't think it's a great policy actually anymore. I think it addresses the wrong issue. But as Chancellor, I would not seek to block the Monetary Policy Committee or the Governor of Bank of England from implementing the policy design.
So that's one yes, one no, and one if you must. My thanks to financial blogger Francis Coppola, Stephen Jones, Chief Investment Officer at Kames Capital, and Toby Nangle from Columbia Threadneedle. We'll be back next week.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.